Good evening. Welcome to the Soleri Report. Today is December 12th, 2013. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Well, it's the holiday season. We love the holiday seasons at Soleri. And of course, we have our holiday card up on the blog. It's Santa in a spacecraft with a reindeer pulling it. Check it out. We've listed our donations. We take a lot of time and really choose out some of our favorite charities to give to at the end of the year. So check them out. It's up on the blog. And we also have Give the Gift. It's our way of extending your budget at Christmas. If you're a Soleri subscriber, we want to give a 2 months complimentary subscription to the person of your choice. So let us know at customer service how we can provide a complimentary subscription to the person of your choice. Check it out on the blog, Gift of Soleri. Our theme tonight is Waiting for the Financial Godot. It's based on Samuel Beckett's play, Waiting for Godot, in which the two characters wait throughout and in vain through the whole play for someone named Godot. And I posted a commentary up on the blog this week, and I said that life in the financial markets increasingly feels like Beckett's masterpiece, where everybody's waiting for Godot. Some people are waiting for the U.S. budget and the Federal Reserve and QE, and so sort of hanging on the pro-centralization team. And that's not good, because, in fact, if you look at those people who are getting something done, they're ignoring Washington and the pro-centralization proceeding. I know it's difficult, since that team has such a great way of coming around and harvesting the value that we create. But I pointed out that the most important message, I think, of 2013 was that guns won. The effort to strip the American people of the right of self-defense didn't work. So it shows you what happens when we turtle forward. I got a wonderful comment from a subscriber who, upon reading the commentary, wrote, let me read it. I nearly reached another one of those times today. I was going to ask you if collapse is gaining a stronger likelihood. All the sources keep pressing it. A wonderful Austin caregiver I know works diligently fearing imminent collapse for at least the last 3 years that I've known the person. I read your new article, and processing in that shift, I write my friend and shared perhaps some synopsis of the likely control we live with and refer to your new article. I think I better take your article to heart myself. Otherwise, collapse will occur every day after tomorrow until I die. And sure enough, it's not unlike waiting for the Fed or waiting for the budget. We keep waiting for some form of normalcy to come back. And in fact, collapse, if you listen to the different articles as to why people think it's going to collapse, is because they're hoping for a return to normalcy. And in fact, if you understand the financial repression that's upon us as part of the slow burn, even you could call it financial invasion, very much part of the ongoing digital invasion of our lives. What you need to know is, don't wait for the financial Godot. We need to proceed to build a future without the benefit of that normalcy returning. I hope it does, but don't bet the ranch. Money and markets, the financial markets, really ground down, not in a big way this week. It was a sideways correction with a continuing down. The equity markets corrected. Bond prices falling because interest rates are rising. You know, we're going to be doing a big presentation on the fixed income markets in the equity overview in January. Chuck Gibson and I have agreed that we're going to go to work on bonds. I'm very glad about that, because the bond market is the dog wagging the tail and the equity markets is the tail. So we need to talk about what's next for bonds, and I hope you join us for that in January. IPOs continued. Hilton came out with the biggest IPO, largest hotel IPO to date. So the IPO market continues. Precious metals got a little bit of bounce at the beginning of the week, but didn't look good today. IAM Gold canceled its dividend. That's not good for that market and the miners, because IAM Gold was known as the miner with a low-cost structure that could produce an attractive dividend. So if they suspend their dividend, It shows you tough times ahead. Now, I thought we'd get a bounce in the equity markets on the announcement of a U.S. budget deal. We have Paul Ryan and Patty Murray coming out, negotiating for both sides, coming out with a proposal for the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2013, essentially a two-year budget deal. In some respects, that's very good news. The summary link is up on the blog. Check it out. There's several characteristics of this deal. One is that it's very modest. And what's frightening is if you look at what they had to do to get a modest deal, it makes you wonder what's going to happen when they have to get something significant. Clearly, the message to Congress from both the bottom constituencies and the grassroots and from Mr. Global is figure it out, get it done. It's clear Mr. Global doesn't want to lose control. And the danger is if they have more messy government shutdowns, et cetera, you're going to start to see a lot of people bottom up start to realize, you know, we can control these cash flows. We don't have to keep running this money through the central mechanism. This deal is not done yet. You know, it still has to be approved, and it's not a slam dunk from here to there, although I think Mr. Global, again, does not want any mess. We continue to publish different aspects of the Fiscal Cliff article. That article is as relevant today as it was last Christmas time when I wrote it, and I really encourage you, if you want to understand the deeper story in the budget, to check it out. The most chilling part of the budget deal is Willie Horton once said he robbed banks because that's where the money is. In that same vein, what we're watching is the pension funds and retirement arrangements really used as a source of funding for all sorts of stuff across the board, both through the front door and the back door. But in the U.S. budget deal, it would require increased contributions to government and military pension funds, and that those increased contributions would be booked as revenues to balance the budget. And of course, the money would go out in spending. It would not be reserved. Those are not funded. You know, you don't have assets escrowed to back those promises. So the increased revenues into the retirement funds would be spent on current spending, while the same amount would be reflected as future liabilities of the government. This is one of the countless reminders of the old maxim that possession is 9/10 of the law, because what we're seeing in pension funds around the country, Detroit the latest example, if the assets are gone, the promises could get gone too. Behind the scenes, one of the things you don't see, although it shows up in the performance in the industrial sector and the aerospace sector in the stock market, is the military-industrial complex is working on a quiet revolution on how they operate. They're going from the cost-plus model that they've been on for many decades to something I believe far more productive. So I think what's going on in the industrial sector in the stock market is not just spin. It's a quiet revolution, but it's profound. One window into part of the federal budget came to the fore this week when we were informed by the cleaners 10 miles away that they're going to close down. We're going to have to drive 45 minutes to do a cleaner near where I get my groceries. And what's the reason? They can't find help. They can't find anybody who's willing to work in the cleaning establishment. And I suspect it's also related to the fact that if you look at the increased load that all the rules and regulations are putting on payrolls, it's also getting very expensive, and so they can't afford to pay what it takes to draw. What was important to understand about that story is if you look at the checks that come in into this area for disability welfare and unemployment and food stamps or the digital cards, it's absolutely unbelievable. And we're watching the small business infrastructure literally choke on absence of labor, and yet the federal government is funding enormous amounts of living expenses and overhead here in counties all across America. So if you look at one of the big tensions in the federal budget, it's how you're going to keep those cash flows coming. State and local pension funds continue to experience troubles. There's a very interesting press release from CalPERS on the Detroit bankruptcy, and some comments from the LA Times that I put up on the blog. We see Treasury selling its final tranche of General Motors stock, saying it now lost $10.5 billion on the GM bailouts, but net on the total bailouts has made a profit. I so profoundly disagree with their accounting treatment of all of this that it's so profound and the situation is so ridiculous. I've decided I'm not going to spend any more time talking about it or delving into it. The reality is that when you give the bankers $27 trillion, it's very hard to turn around and say you made a profit on it. Although, you know, we could debate this till the cows come home, but to me, it's all yeah. The Volcker Rule has been approved. That rule has been working through the financial regulators since it was passed as part of the Dodd-Frank bill in 2010. One of the questions from subscribers, what are the real implications of the Volcker Rule and what are the obvious directions that the banks are going to take to sidestep their supposed inability? The Volcker Rule does bring in stricter limits on proprietary trading. Essentially, the idea is you shouldn't be able to borrow money using the federal credit and then turn around and put it into high-risk trading that causes your bank to be at risk and to put the federal credit at more risk. Wall Street's, I think, been adjusting and getting ready for this since the legislation was passed. You saw after the legislation was passed, many, many proprietary trading functions cut back or closed. If you watch Goldman Sachs and JP Morgan stock this week relative to the markets, it seems to me that there's not much of an impact. I think the big banks still have plenty of ways to do proprietary trading offshore, but technically it does protect somewhat against the federal credit. But as long as they're solvent, it's generally difficult to stop completely. If anything, what you've done is you've created a much more complicated situation for all the financial institutions. On one hand, you're giving them tons of federal credit, which is, you know, a little bit like giving them financial candy and heroin, and then saying, okay, now we need to regulate you more carefully so that you don't party too much. And I think there's much simpler ways of dealing with the situation, like not giving them the federal credit. But that's a topic for a whole nother day. A lot of the high risk things they're doing, as far as I'm concerned, were part of a national security plan, one way or the other. They were either doing them with the federal credit as agent for the Exchange Stabilization Fund, or that it was part of engineering the financial coup d'état. The Fed has cleaned up a lot of the fraudulent paper with the QEs, and that means there's a lot less systemic risk in the financial system. There's still plenty, but there's a lot less. The coup is over. Now the big issue is how do you cut the excess capacity in the financial system? Because as long as there's a federal credit arbitrage and you're giving people federal credit, they're going to want to turn around and make money on it because it's kind of a rigged deal. And that's one of the reasons I say the statement that they made money on TARP is, and the bailouts is, you know, I strongly disagree. The excess capacity issue is why I've said the bail-ins are coming, and sure enough, we have the Bank of England and a variety of other players in Europe saying bail-ins are coming. So what exactly that means, we still don't know. Of course, what it does mean is that the losses hit the depositors instead of the taxpayers, as happens in bailouts. I think it depends on how much is involved in the bail-ins, how quickly. But certainly there's a lot of excess capacity to cut both in Europe and here, and it's coming. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, God bless WikiLeaks, they dumped out a second release of Trans-Pacific Partnership agreement documents. What you can see is their deep divisions as America keeps pushing and forcing things that give it centralized control around the world. Issues like genetically modified organisms, and that's up on the blog. One of the most fascinating stories of 2013 and one that will be ongoing into 2014 is the Vatican reengineering. This is radical. It's impossible to understand exactly what's happening, but the fact that we're looking at the greatest money laundering network ever created is being opened up to transparency, and the Pope is insisting he's trying to cut the flow through the Vatican Bank. You kind of wonder exactly where the flow will go through now and what this is all about. Time magazine has made Pope Francis Man of the Year, so check it out on the blog. There's a couple of very interesting stories. Trojan horses. One of the most frustrating things about being Catherine Austin Fitz is you see lots of wonderful people get way excited about wonderful ideas that you know are Trojan horses and are simply going to result in radical increases of control and financial repression. And let me mention two of them, because two of them are looking to move to full blossom. One, about the worst idea in the world, is lots of stories this week around the alternative media about Iceland coming up with a new constitution built through crowdfunding. It could be a great idea in Iceland. The idea of anybody opening up the constitution in the United States is the most terrifying thing in the world. If you think the powers that be cannot hijack the process, you are dead wrong. They can and they will, and don't for a minute think that, you know, the various groups pushing a new constitution, including by this method, aren't one way or another mind controlled or funded or encouraged, many times innocently without their realizing it by this effort. So if anybody suggests to you we ought to have a new constitution in America and we ought to do it with crowdfunding, tell them no. Second thing is the Royal Mint is now in talks to create a gold-backed Bitcoin. A wonderful piece from Gonzo Lira up on the blog earlier this week. It's called Bitcoin's a Fully Compliant Currency the Government Can Love. What it explains is why Bitcoin's really is the way into a global digital currency that will give government unbelievable and invasive control. And, of course, government only a tool to the powers that be that behind it. So Bitcoin's is, I believe, one way or another, brought to you by Mr. Global. We'll be talking about it more on the Solari Report in 2014. But check out, we put a commentary up on the blog this week with links to the various stories about the interests of a gold-backed Bitcoin and where that stands. But I assure you it's going to give Mr. Global two things he's always wanted. Now that he's stolen everything, he can introduce sound currency, which helps him keep it. And the other is every, unlike gold coins, which give enormous privacy and freedom and really do support financial freedom, this one is completely invasive, and it's as bad for the average guy. A gold-backed Bitcoin is going to be about the most financially repressive thing going. Space, the final frontier. We had a wonderful summit here in Hickory Valley with the Solari team yesterday, and one of the things we talked about was having a quarterly space report, because I think space is going to be so important to the investment scene going forward. But if ever there was two examples of the importance of space, NASA announced it's going to grow a garden on the moon. Can you imagine that? Apparently, there are no food safety rules on the moon, so let's see what happens. I also pulled out the Wall Street Journal, a big fancy glossy in the middle of the Wall Street Journal this last Saturday, with lots of ads for Christmas presents and a two-page ad for the new lunar moon watch from Chanel. I said, oh, now that the model has of space investment has been privatized, here we go. Our hero this week is Cort Skinner. Cort Skinner is the president of the board of Greater Montessori Creative Learning Center in East Palo Alto. It's one of our donations this year. He was the founder and chair of the one of our donations last year, Computers for Everyone, wonderful not-for-profit in Menlo Park, California, that makes takes secondhand and parts and donations and does a lot to make technology accessible to everybody in that community. It's a wonderful thing. This year we asked our wonderful cartoonist Bob Parsons to make a tune for some of the leadership that inspired our donations. And so we're going to have a picture and a little description of Cort up on the blog. He's one of my favorite people in the world. His grandson Keegan says Cort Skinner is the smartest man in America, and that's very easily possibly true. He's certainly one of the smartest human beings I've ever known, but smart not just in terms of unbelievable intellect. He had a very successful career in Silicon Valley, but also wise in the ways of the world and adds more value per hour and square foot than just about any human being I've ever met. So, Cort Skinner, thank you for all that you do, and we hope our donation to Greater Montessori helps and inspires other donations. It's a wonderful, wonderful organization, well worth your support. Ask Catherine, we had great questions for Jim Norman this week, who we did the interview with, and so I'm not going to address those. We were able to get Jim to cogitate with us on all of the questions you asked, so check out the interview. Another question is, am I going to do a lunch in the Palm Springs area? On my next trip to California this spring, I will drive through Palm Springs either on the way out or back. And, you know, that's a great idea. I think we will look into doing a lunch in that area because everybody from L.A. can come over if they'd like. Another question. Dear Catherine, in your opinion, was John F. Kennedy Jr. Intentionally killed when his plane went down, or was it an accident? If he was intentionally killed, why did powerful people suddenly want him dead? He's talking about the president's son. I believe the odds were quite high that he was assassinated. There are various theories on why it happened. One was that he was going to run for the Senate at the same time Hillary Clinton was planning on run. And given sort of his background and abilities, he had a very good chance of winning. There are other people who either wanted that seat, Clinton being one of them, or who wanted Clinton to have it. That's one of the theories. Also, the theory was, of course, he was the publisher of George magazine. One of the stories was he was going to publish the story of what really happened, the true story in and around his father's assassination. And then another theory was that the people who killed his father their kids could make their bones killing the son. That sounds a little far-fetched to many people, but I assure you it's a lot less far-fetched than you might think. Anyway, those are some of the theories. I have no idea what the truth is. I think the chances, for a variety of reasons, including those that he was assassinated, are very, very good. Our interview, great interview with Jim Norman. He's one of my favorite people to talk about. One of the things he describes is that there is an extraordinary and deep conviction on this planet to remain with fossil fuel. It's very strong. I put this story up on the blog today, Exxon announcing that natural gas will be 25% of the energy supply globally within the not too distant future. It's a very important story and one to take seriously. And so Jim, I think, does a very good job of describing why that's so. And we went through many of the different areas, both what's going on in fossil fuel, the controversy around fracking and why it will probably come out in favor of fracking, the use of renewable energy and it's the fact that it's growing and where it stands. I mentioned a little bit about breakthrough energy, but that's a long way off to get that adapted. Anyway, it was a very interesting interview, and I would encourage you to listen to it. We did take an hour and a half, so we did go for quite a bit. But if you look at the importance of energy to what's about to happen or what's happening in North America, I can't stress it enough. As Jim said, the cost of manufacturing in North America is 40 to 50% energy. So this is an energy story. And one of the things Jim does a great job of explaining is why North America has such a tremendous advantage. If you haven't read his Oil Card, I know I keep pounding this pavement. If you have not read his book, Oil Card, as far as I'm concerned, it is the best book on the energy markets I've ever read, and a very solid explanation from a very seasoned reporter with deep roots in this industry as to how that market works. And I think he's nailed it. So it's been out for more than a couple of years, but it's as relevant today as it ever was. Get it if you can, The Oil Card. Let's go to the movies. I had said I wanted to do The Warning, which is a PBS documentary about the efforts of Brooks Lieborn to regulate derivatives during the Clinton administration. But then I saw Netflix documentary done by Bloomberg Businessweek, Hank, 5 years from the brink, whereas former Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson tries to justify the bailouts. And Lord, it's painful to watch. These are both stories told from the point of view of the official story. The Warning is useful in the sense that it describes a very solid, very capable, very well-connected, credible player trying to do something about derivatives, which was very much within her scope, and being slammed by Greenspan, Summers, and Rubin in a way that is frightening and literally being pushed out of government. And so it shows you the importance of derivatives to those players and leaving derivatives sort of unattended in the shadow markets. And you can see it very clearly. What you don't see is anything about why that is so. So you don't get an overview of the real reengineering of the financial system and the sort of the governance on planet Earth. It doesn't take you into the deeper story, but it does do a good job of showing the importance of derivatives to doing so. Hank, 5 years from the brink, is very painful to watch. Whereas Hank Paulson basically defends and promotes the official reality. One of our subscribers wrote in and says, I hope you point out that his position allowed him to sell his Goldman stocks before the crash without paying any taxes. Yes, that is the case. I think he wouldn't have come unless he could have done that. I don't think that's the reason he became Secretary of the Treasury. But there's no doubt about it. Hank Paulson played the patsy on that part of the story. And anyway, but you will get some of the official story by watching it. It's exceptionally painful. And what you're watching is almost a story of massive disassociation of the official reality from what was really going on. And yet, I will tell you, if you're in that spot and you don't appreciate what is really going on when the music stops, you can understand how he got cornered and rolled, so to speak. Well, those two documentaries, if you want to revisit that period and get more into the official story, again, they don't tell you the deeper story. If you want to understand the deeper story, read my blog post, Financial Coup d'Etat. One of the things I'm reminded when I saw these documentaries is the extent to which during that period, people like Bourne or someone like me or various folks trying to do something about what they were seeing were struggling within their immediate sector. They didn't see the bigger picture. And in the blog post, Financial Coup d'Etat, I talk about being in London with a reporter who had seen what had happened in Russia and another reporter had seen what had happened in East Europe. And I, who had seen what had happened domestically in North America, and we all gave our presentations only to realize in horror that we had each been dealing with one leg of the elephant, but in fact there was an elephant in the room. And we had the same firms, the same law firms, the same investment banks, the same sovereign governments operating globally in literally a financial coup d'etat. And it was a magical moment, because what we all realized was that each one of us in our own sector had been dealing with a global movement that was clearly amazingly coordinated. They knew what they were doing. And that's, of course, why I always try and get you guys to listen to and watch the Sir James Goldsmith video, or read my online book, Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, because, in fact, it was a plan and they knew. And if you watch Rubin and Greenspan and Summers sit down and basically drive born out of government, of course, they were privy to the larger plan. Well, that's it for this evening. In closing, coming up next week, Winter Wellness with Dr. Laura Thompson. We're coming into that season where all sorts of stuff goes on. You get colds, you get flus, we have severe weather, and less sun. Some people get the winter blues. So we wanted to talk about what are all the things you can do to really make sure you sail through and have a healthy and joyous winter. So Winter Wellness with Dr. Laura Thompson. December 26th, day after Christmas, we'll be posting John Rappaport's new report. And then the big one, January 2nd, I'll be doing the year-end wrap-up. We love to get your thoughts and comments. We'll be publishing a commentary that will be up next week, where we're collecting all the best wrap-ups from around the web. Please feel free to post your recommendations or comments, because I want to make sure I do a great job of sort of telling you where we've been in 2013 and where we're headed in 2014. With that wrap-up, we'll be publishing our big poster of the year. In 2013, it was Coming Clean, so we'll be announcing the 2014 poster and have it up on the blog. So until next week, December 19th, with Dr. Laura Thompson, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's my pleasure to welcome back to the Saleri Report Jim Norman, who, of course, needs no introduction on the Saleri Report. One of my favorite things about the doing the work that I do is I get to talk to Jim. So, Jim, I've really, as I've been reading the news, there's so much in the news on energy, and I've been waiting for to get you back on the Saleri Report, because this is where I get the real sort of, you know, 411 on what's going on. So welcome.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Fine. So we're reading in the news every day that the U.S. is now a net exporter of energy and is self-sufficient. And then, of course, the complimentary articles is that's all yaya. So bring us up on what has been happening in terms of U.S. domestic energy and whether or not we have become self-sufficient.
Okay. Well, we are far, far from being energy self-sufficient. I mean, that's those are the wrong words to use by far. I mean, we still import almost half of the oil that we use. Our oil production is going up again after many, many years, mainly because of new technologies and opening up of shale and stuff like that. Plus, our energy use has been moderating. Gasoline demand blipped up recently, but it's been down.
Household income has been going down since 2000, and expenses are going up, so the consumer is getting squeezed. How much of it is the consumer versus manufacturing is just using less?
Well, it's interesting is that manufacturing is energy demand is actually going up a little bit.
Right.
And the key fuel there is natural gas. Now, the crazy thing about these energy markets is that natural gas in relation to oil is really, really cheap. I mean, natural gas in the United States sells for about one-fourth the equivalent BTU price or energy content of crude oil. It's been completely out of whack for more than a decade now, which is one of the points of the book I wrote, The Oil Card, which basically says, for geopolitical purposes, the United States likes high oil prices, and we've basically propped up that market, kept crude prices very, very high. At the same time, we've let natural gas fall. And so what we're actually doing is drawing manufacturing back into the United States. And partly we're doing it with cheap dollar, but also with cheap energy costs. And it's slowly starting to get some traction. So you have this basic irrational dichotomy in the energy market. Gas is cheap. Oil and liquid fuels are expensive. And we're importing less of the liquid fuels. We're actually starting to export small amounts of natural gas. And we could export a lot more, I think.
What, you mean exporting it in liquid as LNG or in gas form as LNG? Yeah, I was just reading a money manager complaining about the fact that the trying to get the permits out of Washington and the West Coast so that they could bring stuff out of North Dakota and convert it was...
for LNG or for oil, probably, for liquid.
I think it was both. They were talking about the difficulties of getting the infrastructure in place to do the exporting both of oil and the LNG.
Right. Well, for 40 years, U.S. policy has been to not export energy. But we're in a position now where we could rethink that and ought to.
Now, fracking, of course, is very controversial. And one of the things I struggle with is trying to understand what the truth is, because there's a very wide opinion on the part of informed people about whether or not it's feasible or safe, you know, the concerns being on the water supply. So I'd love to know, and of course there's very great controversy about whether or not the wells being fracked are really going to produce in a meaningful way. So maybe if you could just describe what fracking is and when it started, how it's evolved, and what you think the real situation is in terms of whether it's something that we should be doing or not.
Okay, I'll give you my 10-cent version. By the way, I'm all for fracking. It makes eminent sense. It's safe if you do it right. The real problem with fracking, and not with fracking per se, but rather with the liquids disposal afterwards, and there have always been laws on the books to regulate that, and there's always been crooks who have dumped the stuff in the wrong place. So there's nothing new under the sun there. But fracking is just a process of drilling a hole in the ground and then pumping fluids in there to bust up the rock. So you get some cracks so that the oil or gas can flow into the well bore and you can get it out. And they've been doing it for, you know, 50 years or more. There's nothing new about that. What's new is that with the combination of horizontal drilling, where you drill down a mile, and then you go horizontal into a oil or gas-bearing layer, you can drill like a mile-long lateral or 2 miles long, and then you frack it in stages, crack the rock in various places along there to get tremendous flows of hydrocarbons out of the well. And all of that cracking of rock goes on so far below any aquifers that it's really just not an issue in terms of groundwater. Where there's an issue with groundwater is near the top. It's a few hundred feet near the surface. And the problem there usually is not fracking, but old well casings, the steel pipe that goes around the well, that goes through the aquifer. A lot of these get corroded or cracked, and they need to be plugged and abandoned. But states are slow about doing that. Companies are negligent. That's where you could get seepage of of natural gas or even hydrogen sulfide, which is poisonous and explosive. You get that into water, and then, you know, people can set their water faucets on fire, I suppose, if they want to. But that problem has been around for a long time, and it has really nothing to do with fracking. So fracking gets a bum rap, I think, and it's going to be, we're just going to get used to it. Because, look, we drill about 40,000 or 45,000 wells a year in the United States. Mm-hmm. More than half of those are horizontal wells, and virtually all of those get fracked. And it just makes so much more sense to drill horizontally and frack them. Most of the vertical wells that are drilled, I think, I could say, are really would eventually go back and they'll drill them horizontally. They just drill them vertically so they could hold the lease with some production. But ultimately, you're going to see, you know, horizontal drilling is going to be just de rigueur, and you're going to see much fracking. The nice, and what they've done is they've actually advanced the fracking technique so that now you can have many, many stages of a frack in a well, small fracks, so you're not busting huge cracks in a rock that go a long distance.
See, what I've always believed is the political problem on fracking is that you can't trust the municipality and the companies to fix it if there's something wrong. So nobody knows when they come into frack if, you know, if you got a bunch of responsible players or a bad dog. Do you know what I mean? So the problem is when something goes wrong, it's not fixed for the, you know, for the consumer.
Yeah. Well, that's where I think if you want to go look for bad guys in that scene, I would go look at state governments that have failed to enforce the plugging and abandonment laws on old wells and on the surface disposal issues, the maybe unlicensed truck drivers, people like that who are dumping drilling fluids of all kinds, not just frack fluids, into municipal waste systems and so forth. So.
Right.
So the other thing you asked about, the longevity of these wells, actually, these kind of wells have very long tails in terms of their production. Some of these gas wells, the decline curves are not as bad as you would think, and the long tails go out 30 years or more in some cases. They don't know how long they're produced. And you can go and frack them again. So it's I think these wells have legs to them. I mean, there's a lot of life here.
Right. Now, I know that there's talk now that the fracking's going to move into Europe. Do you know what the status is of that?
I think it's inevitable. I think it will eventually. It just makes so much sense.
Isn't that going to change Russia's position vis-a-vis natural gas in Europe?
Yes. Well, now, here's where you get into the geopolitical backdrop of all of this stuff. And actually, I think a lot of the environmental hoo-ha you see going on the surface is really just a cover for what are essentially geopolitical issues in the background over pricing and supply. And my basic position is that one of the reasons the U.S. likes high oil prices right now is that we've got to keep the Ruskies solvent some way. As much as we might not like them, they are a necessary foil against the Chinese.
And
although Mr. Putin can have some rather nasty rhetoric, the bottom line is he plays ball with us pretty much down the line on our geopolitical agendas.
And without looking like he's doing it.
Yeah, well, I think he is, because I think he knows on which side his bread is buttered. And I think he knows that if we wanted to, we could tank the oil price again as we have in the past. And he would be out of luck. Because the Russian economy is still very weak. It still depends heavily on oil exports, also gas. And so I think we're happy now to finally let some Russian gas into Europe and let him make some money on that stuff. So
did I ever tell you? Sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Did I ever tell you about the time that one of his advisors tried to recruit me? No, seriously, I was up speaking at a gold conference in the Yukon, and one of his national security advisors was there. And the next thing I know, and this guy was unbelievably, you know, was he? I was very impressed by him. He was very, very smart. And, you know, and just very, you know, they're all very serious members of the Russian Orthodox Church. So they think very long term, very spiritually, very strategically anyway. So anyway, before I know it, as we're leaving, we're flying out together. And I always find this guy sitting next to me. He basically put the move on about, you know, I was on the wrong side and I should come over to their side. And, you know, there were no particulars. But I just turned to him and I said, look, nobody likes a traitor. And then when I got home, I said, you know, there's something wrong about this. This is in 2005, right before the housing bubble burst. So I looked it up and I realized, oh, you know, Russia, the Russian sovereign wealth funds and the big institutions are the second largest holder of Fannie Mae securities. So I wasn't talking to another country. I was basically talking to a big Fannie Mae investor.
Right.
Anyway.
Well, yeah. So...
So things are never as they seem.
That's right. And it's the amazing thing to me about this whole energy market on a broad scale is how little volatility there is in the pricing. I mean, you look at the oil price. It's hovered around this basically $100 a barrel mark for 5-6 years now. I mean, a dip
right.
in 2008. With the financial credit, but then it bounced right back and it's hovered right in there. And the price has really fluctuated very little around that $100 mark. And Russian exports have hardly budged at all. They've been bumping along at 4 million barrels a day ever since 2003, which is the year when they signed basically a market sharing deal with the Saudis. The Russians produce 4 million barrels, export 4 million barrels a day. The Saudis export 8 million barrels a day. And it has moved along in lockstep like that ever since. I mean, it just cries out to, say, market rigging here.
Right.
And
right. And I should say, for those who haven't listened to the previous interviews with Jim, including the ones on his fabulous book, The Oil Card, you know, you absolutely want to do it, because if you want to understand sort of how this market is managed, it's absolutely the best available book and some great interviews. So I would encourage you to do it. But needless to say, you know, China is getting taxed because they're the ones who are paying an arm and a leg for that oil.
Right, right.
And now the Japanese too.
Well, the Japanese... When oil was cheap, their big gig was buying crude cheap, refining it, and selling gasoline and making money as an exporter of gasoline. But a lot of that business has gone away. They've closed down the refineries. Now they're having to burn oil for boiler fuel, basically, in place of nuclear power. But heavy crudes do sell at quite a bit of a discount to the light sweet crude, which means low sulfur, which are
right.
Preferred for making gasoline. So, yeah, the Japanese are in a difficult situation on a number of fronts, and energy is a big one right now. But I think we've been doing a lot to keep some wind in their sails and help them along through this, not to mention bolstering them against any kind of a Chinese threat. So I think the Chinese and the Japanese and the U.S. have drawn much closer lately for a bunch of these reasons.
Really? So the nuclear ban in Japan as a result of Fukushima, does it continue? Is it easing? What's going to happen?
Well,
what's Japan's energy strategy?
I don't know. I don't follow nuclear that much, but every casual headline I read on it looks bad. The radiation
right.
just keeps getting worse, and they don't really have a fix for it. I'm sure with human ingenuity, they'll figure out some way to get plants back online and keep them running. But the idea of building more of them is pretty remote, I think. I think that that industry is pretty much dead now.
Well, looking at, you know, I put the quote up on the blog that from one of our last discussions where you said, you know, energy is 40 to 50% of the cost of manufacturing in the United States, and I think labor is only 5%. So, you know, if you look around the world at Asia, whether it's China, Japan, or the, you know, the Tigers, or Europe, or the United States, one of the most important questions I think about a lot is, what's the relative cost of manufacturing in these different places? And so where's the manufacturing flow gonna go? And if you look at the statistics, you know, the employment, you know, labor as a percent of total costs in the U.S. companies just keeps coming down, down, down. And with robotics and some of the new technology, I'm assuming it's just that that slope's going to continue to go down. So energy is the critical component, is it not?
Right. And that's what I'm saying is that actually U.S. manufacturers are significantly advantaged because of the low cost and ready availability of natural gas in this market. And I think U.S. policy will be to keep that gas price down. I think that's why they drag their feet on LNG exports. They want to keep as much gas in this market as they can to keep the price down. But now remember, the price of gas and oil, they're really not determined so much by physical supply and demand. It's really driven by the futures market, the NYMEX.
Right.
And what you see there is a massive amount of market management both ways, up on oil and down on gas. If you look, I mean, the statistics are very limited and poorly aggregated. But what you have, if you look at in terms of managed money positions in energy, there's a massive long position in oil and a huge short position in gas. that kind of tells you the rationale. And this has no, to me, it has, makes no sense from an investment standpoint. Why you'd be buying crude futures to begin with, unless you have a physical demand that has to be hedged, it's suicidal and ludicrous, unless your agenda is to basically manage that market some way. And so you have huge amounts of money. Actually, not that much money. It only takes like 5% down for your so-called margin to take out a position, you know. And then you just keep rolling that over. You maybe make a little money, lose a little money. But with a relatively small amount of actual cash, you can control a significant amount of oil in the futures market. And I think that's what we've been doing.
Right. When a decision is made at the National Security Council level, you know, you then have, whether it's, you know, you're trading the large companies like Exxon, or you have JP Morgan as agent trading the Exchange Stabilization Fund, you basically are up against 100% of the credit in the world. 100% of the credit of the world is decided it's going to go to the right. And you can't trade against that.
Right, because, and anybody who has tried to short oil has just been slaughtered. You know, it's just, there are no shorts left out there, and there's probably no longs left in gas. So, it's you don't.
In
want
Washington,
to bet
we call that,
and
it's the House. The House has decided where this is going to go, and when you're talking about you know, the governments that have a nuclear arsenal plus the largest companies in the world, you know, and a currency that's on an oil standard, then, you know, you can't, that is the House. Anyway, in Washington, we called it puppy training when you squeeze out all the shorts who think that markets are markets.
That markets are rational. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, they are rational in a way. Anyway. Okay. So what, talk a little bit about the politics of Russia vis-a-vis Europe, because Russia, you know, obviously Europe is a, you know, a ready market for Russia. But if Europe starts to frack, What does that do to Russia? We discussed that. But then we're seeing, you know, the tensions on the Ukraine with Putin basically snatching the Ukraine back out of the European Union. So there seems to me there's some tension there. And my question is, how much does it have to do with oil and gas?
Well, Russia and the Ukraine, they've been at each other's throats for a while. I mean, the Ukrainian government actually tilts more towards Moscow now, but I think the Ukrainian people hate those guys. And so there's a lot of bad blood there that goes back a long ways. And how much of it is energy, I don't know, really. The trouble Putin has is the only thing he's got to sell that's worth any money is oil and gas. The Russians just don't have any much else to sell to the Europeans. In the meantime, you've got the Germans and everybody else, you know, selling all kinds of expensive stuff we're wanting to into Russia. So Russia ends up being more and more dependent on oil and gas. And so I think Putin is just trying to keep the Europeans from basically cannibalizing the former Soviet Union and just encroaching on him to the point where it's just kind of total irrelevancy. So he's trying to keep Europe at bay. At the same time, he's trying to keep the Chinese at bay. Now, that's his real problem. You know, the Chinese and the Russians basically hate each other. They've fought wars with each other. They have a long, long boundary. The Chinese lust for Russian oil and mineral reserves in Siberia, and they could just take them if they wanted to. They would just ride their bicycles up there, and the Russians could hardly stop them. So Putin has been basically trying to keep the Chinese happy with various oil and gas deals, some arms deals, the terms of which are really not that good for the Chinese, and the stuff hardly ever arrives on time, and maybe not at work, but and so he's trying to keep them happy by selling them more oil. Now, the Chinese are having to pay through the nose for that oil. It would actually be cheaper for the Chinese to buy tankers of oil in the Persian Gulf and ship them halfway around the world than to buy oil off that Russian pipeline in the east. But it's always better to have a pipeline supply. It's much more secure than floating oil.
Right.
So Putin has been doing that. He's got a deal pending to sell him some gas. But not only does he charge him an arm and a leg, he makes the Chinese pay in advance, like 10 years in advance.
You're kidding. Well, they're probably trying to dump their dollars.
Well, you know, there's an interesting thing. The Chinese have recently gone to bilateral agreements on trade, which lets them more and more pay in their own yuan currency.
Right.
Now, this is very intriguing to me because the essence of the Chinese strategy has been to keep their currency low so that they are able to sell into other people's markets, particularly the U.S. What I think has been happening, people look at this yuan export pricing phenomenon as some kind of a sign of strength on the part of the Chinese. Actually, I tend to look at it in reverse, because what I think it means is that the Chinese realize they're being crippled by this very low currency they have. It costs them, they're buying very expensive commodities with a very undervalued currency. So they're looking for a way to basically get the value of their currency up without trashing their exports. And one way to do that would be with these bilateral deals. But what the net effect of that is that basically it's pushing up the value of the Chinese currency in these bilateral deals. And that's, in long term, that's going to be difficult for them. And the Chinese, I think, are in a very difficult currency situation. And every other kind of situation. I mean, they're short on energy. They're buried in debt. They have a very brittle political system. It's rife with corruption. They are totally dependent on exporting into other people's markets. And the whole world is starting to gang up on them now. And I think the U.S., it doesn't appear that way to the public, but I think the U.S. actually has a significant upper hand against the Chinese now as a result of all this accumulation of strategies that they think are being pursued.
Right, I agree with you. I think the Chinese, the biggest problem you have, if you're leading China, you wake up each day and you think, how am I going to keep a billion people employed? And in a world where, right, in a world where automation is completely changing the competitive landscape vis-a-vis, you know, so on manufacturing and all these things you're doing, how are you going to keep those people employed? And how are you going to keep them employed in a world where you have significant pollution and water and natural resource issues? So, you know, because there's oil, but then there's water as well. So I don't think it's so easy to be China. Now, what I will say is the Chinese people, you know, I used to live in Hong Kong and I've traveled to China. The Chinese people are the most amazing. You know, they are unbelievably productive, as are the Japanese. So I never like to underestimate the power of what they can do, because they're about the hardest working people on the planet. So they're pretty amazing.
Right, right. I think the U.S. attention, though, is at the ruling elite in the People's Republic. Those are the guys we'd like to see go away, probably. And I think with even a modicum of social unrest there, I think you could wake up one day and that whole Beijing crowd could just be gone for the hills. You know, it's just, it could be that kind of a thing, very sudden and very dramatic. And then the whole deck would get reshuffled some way. So, in fact, now I may be hallucinating on this one, but even this Iran situation is intriguing to me. My contrarian self is tending to look at that as yet another case of where the U.S. may actually be prying away from China a potentially a valuable client state here in the Iranians. I just have a suspicion that that's what's going on here. That basically what's really going on is saying, hey, look, Iran, play ball with the West. Don't go with the Chinese. Don't buy their arms. Don't build their nuclear plants. And don't get in bed with them geopolitically. And, you know, life could be nice for you again. That sort of.
Well, the deal with Iran only happened when basically the invasion of Syria got shut down. In other words, I remember right after 9/11, I was in church, and we were presented literally with a battle plan in various sermons. You know, first we were going to go to Afghanistan, then we were going to go to Iraq, then we were going to go to Libya, then we were going to go to Syria, and then we were going to go into Iran. And I'll never forget, there's a video up on my blog of Wesley Clark saying that he was over at the Pentagon and the same thing happened. He was given the battle plan then. And when the president basically came forward and said, we've got to bomb, we've got to attack Syria, literally, you know, there was no traction. There was no way you could get Congress to go along with it. And I think that, if anything, Putin stepped in and saved the administration from embarrassment because Congress was going to turn him down. So, so something happened there, which was the Americans couldn't do what they wanted to do, or, you know, and I've never quite understood what the real story was. But
well, what I wonder about that is whether we might have won without firing a shot. I mean, it's possible that, in fact, that the deal was, look, the Russians and the Chinese knew that they could not effectively defend Syria if
right.
we really went after them. And so they're the ones who actually would have backed down on that a bit. I mean, as it is now, we're openly arming the rebels there, and they
right.
still remain a force in being. Assad ain't home free yet.
Right.
Sooner or later, he's going to go, and so I wouldn't say the Russians and Chinese had a particularly strong hand to play there. And it wasn't.
I don't mean to say that they had a strong hand. I just think that, you know, we're in a funny situation where the administration, where the U.S. administration, you know, the discrepancy between the story and the official story has reached unbearable distances. And so trying to get something like that accomplished politically has become very difficult.
Yeah, right.
So.
Yes. Well, as we said, nothing is what it appears to be. That's a good rule of thumb in any of
right.
that stuff.
Well, what do you think will happen with Iran?
Well, given the amount of that this deal will probably fall apart before it gets consummated. We'll be back at each other's throats before long.
Is it possible to make a deal?
It's hard for me to see how you do that. I mean, it's not just the bad blood between the U.S. and Iran, but the Saudis are in this too. And the Saudis hate those guys, are scared to death of them, don't trust them. And
right.
we're not gonna cast adrift the Saudis, no matter
right.
what.
Right.
So I don't think the Iranians are going to get that much out of this deal. My contrarian view is that U.S. defense policy really doesn't care one way or the other whether Iran has a bomb. I think
right.
the way the U.S. looks at that is that in a de facto sense, they probably already do have that capability. You'd have to assume that they do. But the thing is, you can't use a weapon like that without basically ending your own civilization.
Right.
And so those kind of weapons become more of a liability than an asset. I think U.S. attitude is, well, okay, go ahead. Build yourself
right.
a bomb. See where that gets you. You know, it's just...
Right.
Iran having a bomb is its own worst punishment, I think. And they ought to know that. But I think they're desperate. They're absolutely desperate. I mean, their crude exports are down to half what they ought to be, a couple of million barrels a day. They should be doing 4 or 5 million barrels a day. I think the sanctions are hurting them bad.
Right.
And they're desperate. So I think they're willing to trade whatever they can to try and get some breathing room.
So is it possible that they could ever improve relations with the Saudis, or is that just an impossibility?
I would not hold my breath on that.
Okay.
It would just be a very long time, I think. It's possible. I think, you know, the Saudis and the Russians cut that market sharing deal back in 2003. They get along okay now, I think. It's always possible. But the main problem is making enough room in a very sloppy oil market to, you know, let these guys in. This is the problem. The world is basically swimming in crude. People,
right.
I know, think I'm crazy when I say that. But it's true. I mean, there is ample crude oil all over the place.
Uh-huh.
OPEC has had to basically restrict its production in order to keep the price up. The Russians could be exporting twice as much as they are. They're holding back. And with us increasing our crude production, it certainly doesn't help things. Backing crude out back into Mexico and Venezuela. Venezuela used to sell like 4 million barrels a day, mostly in the U.S. Now they're selling less than 1 million barrels a day.
Right.
And we're actually exporting gasoline to Venezuela now. I mean, it's the world is upside down. So Venezuela has basically been taken off of the charts. Nigeria is limping along. They used to be cheating like mad. Now they can barely support themselves. Libya, it's like they're producing 200,000 barrels a day. That's like a tenth of what they used to do. And there's a bunch of these other problematic countries that have just kind of been taken off of the order of battle here. Sudan, South
right.
Sudan, their production is like nothing anymore.
Right.
So But you have to do that because otherwise the physical crude market would be swimming in oil. I mean, world inventories of crude now, they're like double what they ought to be in terms of the day's supply.
Plus, so our holding up the oil price is causing a lot of the producers pain, the smaller producers, a lot of pain.
Holding up the oil price?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. The smaller producing countries.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's true because I think that they're having a harder time finding their way into the market here. And I think that with, just a little bit of monkeying around, you can cause enough havoc, pipeline explosions here and there and rebel movements, blah, blah, blah.
It's amazing when the price starts to fall, you get those explosions.
We have ways of dealing with cheaters in the oil market, and it's always been the case. So basically OPEC has had to pull in its horns, and everybody else has to keep this market from getting sloppy. If you're gonna control the price on the NYMEX, you just need to keep the market snug physically out there.
Right.
That's why this whole Keystone Pipeline thing to me is an intriguing thing. I mean, this cannot be an environmental issue over whether you build a pipeline over the Ogallala aquifer or whatever it is. No, I think it's all about keeping Canadian crude bottled up there so you don't trash the price by dumping huge amounts of crude on the Gulf Coast.
Now, talk a little bit about the Keystone Pipeline. What is it and who's for and who's against and what's really going on?
Yeah, well, this is, again, where I think what meets the eye is not necessarily what's really going on. Everybody has, the Canadians want to build another big pipeline out of Canada to move Syncrude or from the tar sands down to first to Cushing, Oklahoma, which is a big storage point and a delivery point for the NYMEX contract. And then from there on down to the Gulf Coast where you could basically displace yet more Mexican and Venezuelan heavy crude in the refineries down there. Well, they've already got there's a big pipeline system that goes into Chicago and Illinois and all that stuff. But the key thing would be to get this heavy crude down to Cushing because that's where it would really then they have another lake which has just opened. They're just filling it up now. They would take this stuff from Cushing down to the Gulf Coast to Houston and Port Arthur where the big refineries are. What that would do, I think, first of all, it would bring a whole bunch more Canadian crude into Cushing. Now, Cushing is already chock-a-block with crude reserves. I mean, it's got there's like 60 million barrels sitting around in tanks there for no good reason. And so that's been a drag on the NYMEX price for a while. This is not good. They need to relieve that inventory overhang there. So what's happened is they're opening this new pipeline to the Gulf Coast. I think that's actually going to raise the NYMEX price because I think it'll take some of these excess inventories out of Cushing, move them to the Gulf Coast, so they won't be such a drag on the NYMEX price. And then I think they're probably going to continue to dally and drag their feet on bringing the other pipeline down from Canada to Cushing so that you won't flood Cushing with more of that crude. That's what I'm thinking. That's just my guess. But I think if you were to open the floodgates and let that Canadian crude flow into Cushing and into the Gulf Coast, it would be more difficult to keep the NYMEX crude price inflated the way it is. There'd be a drag on it, and you just don't want to do that. And unless you could come up with some way politically that would allow crude oil exports, but I just don't think that's ever going to happen. Not as long as we're still importing half of our crude. And to let the Canadians export crude through the Gulf Coast, I just don't think it's going to happen. So you don't think the pipeline will happen?
I think they're
going to keep it bottled up as long as they can. Yeah, and until they can find a real home for that crude.
So that means more money flowing to environmentalists.
Yes, who I think, in my cynical view, and I'll, I I know I'll be pilloried for this, but...
No, not by me, because you know something? Whenever the environmentalist activity, you know, skyrockets and you dig back down, what you find is, sure enough, that's where the money's coming from.
That's
so,
right. I mean, it's from the government or some rival corporate interest, you know, and they use these environmental groups as shills for whatever, you know.
Right, who have no, most of them have no idea that's how they're being used.
No,
they really don't know.
It's, you know, it's shameful, but it's completely understandable and should be expected, I guess.
Right. So speaking of shills, I want to talk about renewable energy, but before I do, I want to start with a couple weeks ago, suddenly Al Gore's on the TV talking about how there's a tremendous amount of oil and market capitalization in the equity markets and the financial markets from oil and gas stocks, and it's all about to become worthless because of renewable energy. And you know, everybody should be careful about putting money in oil and gas stocks. Of course, he's partner in a money management firm. And now, in fact, this follows an article about a month or two ago from The Economist saying that $500 billion of utility stocks in Europe have been shaved by renewable energy, in fact. Anyway, but so Gore's, you know, trumping around on TV screaming all of this, and suddenly, magically, campaigns start across the country at lots of universities to get the endowments to divest oil and gas stocks. And I'm looking at this, shaking my head, saying, okay, what's this? Because you never have a campaign roll out like this with this much force unless it's centrally planned. So I said, okay, what's the story on the Al Gore and university endowment campaign attack on oil and gas stocks? Where's this coming from? And there's a very, you know, I'm a person who's given the Harvard Endowment plenty of hard time, including the guys who used to run their oil and gas portfolio or the guys who used to run their real estate portfolio, and their shenanigans in Washington was so horrible. It was, you know, my belief was they should lose their tax exemption. But anyway, so I'm somebody who's certainly given the Harvard Endowment a hard time, but it was really wonderful because the person who spoke for the endowment in the university said with a plaintiff plea, I have a hard time selling stocks of companies whose products everybody is using, meaning the people campaigning against those stocks, of course, are driving around in cars and buying gas from the same people at the same time. So the hypocrisy is off the charts anyway, but it's all very funny, and you look at it and you kind of shake your head and you say, well, you know, what's this about? I have no idea yet.
My hunch is that this is a shakedown. It's extortion in the simplest terms. The oil and gas industry now is loaded with cash. I mean, you can't help but make lots of money at $100 a barrel. And in fact,
right. What is their cost per barrel? If the price is 100, what's their cost per barrel?
ExxonMobil's finding and development cost, all in, to find, develop, and bring on production a barrel of oil is under $20.
Right.
But get this. This is a company that its capital spending is less than half of its cash flow. In other words, they're reinvesting only half of the cash they're generating in the business. They're paying a huge dividend. They're buying back lots of their stock. Their cash on the balance sheet is more than their debt.
Right.
They're just a huge cash cow. Most of these majors are in similar position. So I think the political powers that be have targeted this whole class of people to figure out how we can shake money out of that tree. And direct taxation is probably doesn't look good. But if you can basically shake them down and scare them and persuade them to funnel money to you in other means, you know, then you're home free. I mean, what it'll mean is a ramp up in lobbyist spending and all that kind of stuff to stave off these kind of punishments. They have lots of ways of moving that money around, and I think that the political powers are going after it.
Right, or certain factions.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily everybody. Before we go to renewable coal, so natural gas prices being as low as they are is certainly reducing coal's market share. What's the future of coal?
Well, coal is still hard to beat as an energy source. I mean, there's just so many BTUs there that the Chinese understand this. They're burning more and more of the stuff because it's the most cost-effective BTUs they're going to find anywhere. Even if they have to ship it halfway around the world from the United States, they're going to burn coal. And there's no way you're going to shame them into burning natural gas, I don't think, even if they're choking to death on that smog.
Right.
So, I mean, there's going to be a market for coal.
Right.
I think that I think, though, that it's going to be a much longer haul before you get the coal gasification movement going full steam, which would basically, you take coal, you cook it, you make carbon monoxide and hydrogen, and so you get syngas, and then you can put that in a pipeline and take it anywhere, burn it, turn it into petrochemicals, all kinds of stuff. I mean, it would be a brilliant thing if you could do it economically. There's just still a lot of technical problems on the price tag on those plants. They're in the multiple billions of dollars. So, it just doesn't seem to be getting off square one. So, that's probably a ways down the road. It's just hard to beat coal for BTUs for energy or oil for transportation fuels.
Right.
So I think that those industries still have a long life to them, especially as manufacturing moves back in the United States and you maybe see a bit of an uptick in steel production in the U.S., then you could see more coal demand there, too.
Right.
So I think...
Well, the utilities here still have a big coal-using infrastructure. So.
Right, and they're not going to shut that down, I don't think. I think they could extend the life of these plants many, many years. And coal use in the United States, I mean, it's quite clean. There's very little soot or sulfur going up in that flue anymore. There's still trace elements of stuff. You know, you get a little bit of mercury and things like that when you burn coal. But I think even the amounts of that stuff are being reduced.
Right.
So,
okay, renewable energy. Every sign seems to be it's increasing by small amounts steadily. I know we certainly often get reports about the price of solar panels coming down. And there seems to be sort of a policy commitment to trying and using a little bit of everything. So what's happening with renewable energy, and is there any hope of it becoming price competitive?
Well, the short answer is no. I don't think it's really going to become price competitive without massive subsidies. I mean, the reason solar panel costs are coming down is because that whole industry was so overbuilt, half the makers have gone bust. And so you've got these idle plants sitting around. You got to run them if you can and just make whatever you can. The wind power energy, I think that thing is has hit or will hit a brick wall here because it's just is not generating the kind of returns they expected. It's turned into an environmental eyesore. And a gigantic bird-killing machine.
Right.
California, I was reading somewhere, they've got like 10,000 of these windmills just sitting there idle, just dangling there because they're not worth fixing. It's so expensive to go up there and replace the generator and all that stuff that they just sit there. And then the promoters go bust. And then who does it? I mean, it's subsidies... you know, they create all a whole new set of problems here when you subsidize fundamentally uneconomic economic behavior. Somebody ends up paying big time for it.
About a couple years ago, I remember reading a piece in the Council on Foreign Relations that just in foreign affairs that was promoting the idea we ought to have a robust energy base, so we ought to use lots, or not lots, but we ought to try and use all these different renewable energies and develop them. And the question was, why? Where's the policy commitment coming to try and use lots of these different energies if we haven't gotten them to a point where they're cost competitive?
Well, I don't know. I mean, there's something fundamentally illogical about this. Doing uneconomic things. Actually, though, what it seems to me is a lot of this is just window dressing. There's lots of talk, but nobody's really making it work very well.
Right.
I mean, when you talk about shaving vast amounts of market value off of European utilities, it's because they have to pay through the nose to buy this overpriced alternative energy. It fundamentally lowers the value of the company to do that. And you get that in the United States, too, with these mandates.
So it's really the subsidy that's shaving the money off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
okay.
It works in reverse.
It's the theory by trying this stuff and subsidizing it, we'll learn how it works and we'll figure out how to make it economic. I mean, what's the theory behind doing it?
Well, I don't really understand the theory. I mean, the idea is that there's a free lunch out there somewhere, but there ain't. And these technologies don't work anywhere near what they were expected to. They're much more expensive, and they're not reliable. They're not as reliable as tried and true fossil fuels in most cases.
Right.
So.
Right.
I think we're stuck with oil and gas for a long time.
Well, you know, part of the issue is even if you could get solar or some of the renewable energies to be very economic, you know, the reality is the dollar is on an oil standard, and you can't change the energy model without changing the currency model. So there's, you know, it's all an, you know, it's a financial ecosystem. And so it's very difficult to change one without changing the other. And so it's, to me, this is not just about the energy. It's about the whole, how you organize the financial system. And changing the global currency is a pretty complex, big thing to do. I was just out at a conference in Boulder called Breakthrough Energy. And I went to they had one in Holland in last year and then one in Boulder this year. And, of course, it's all the inventors working on other forms of energy that are supposed to be more efficient than or more productive than renewable energy. You know, and there's wide divergence as to whether people believe that stuff exists. Now, I believe it exists, but getting it to the point where it could be integrated into the infrastructure and economic and risk managed, that's a whole different kettle of fish. But I didn't know if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, it seems to me they ought to be able to find a multitude of forms of economical, renewable energy sources. But there's no free lunch. I mean, a lot of these have significant pollution effects with them that you have to mitigate some way. You know, in biofuels, you burn that stuff, you get nasty stuff as well. And
right.
So it's... I think we do need to be working on many, many fronts to deal with this stuff. But my basic feeling is that to make the United States really work well, I think the way it used to is you gotta remain a low cost supplier of stuff. And what's unfortunately happened over time, we've larded up our whole governmental and business structure with you know, huge layers of costs, which maybe have no noble social intent, but I think are probably not so effective, and have basically priced us out of the global market in many ways. We're trying to.
You're being way too nice.
Yeah. Well, we're trying to compensate for that now by driving down our own currency, which is kind of like shooting yourself in the foot.
And yeah, we've layered on, you know, centuries of control rules that have created an unproductive complexity, which is ridiculous. I posted a rant on the blog the other day because Black Friday was clearly disappointing for many of the retailers. And literally the next day, the president is out saying you should increase the minimum wage, at which point I said, well, why don't you just stop doing the 4,550 million things you're doing to destroy people's income?
Yeah, really?
Instead of, you know, mandating that their income increase when you, you know, it's really has become like Atlas Shrugged. And
people are just getting more and more frustrated and running out of patience. But of course, there's nothing anybody can do, or it feels like that.
Well, the funny thing is, markets work. Markets really work. And one of the challenges we're facing is if you have a national security goal of wanting to keep the Chinese in check, then you manage the price of, you know, oil to a much higher thing, so the market can't work. And so we've reached this point where we have all sorts of policy goals that have us intervening with the markets, whether it's holding the oil price up or making more rules here in the United States. But at some point, you choke on the absence of markets.
Right. And the really biggie is the whole interest rate and currency thing. I mean, our strategy has been to drive down the dollar to basically squeeze the Chinese. Uh-huh. And you do that by zeroing out interest rates, basically. That's what Bernanke's been all about. This is not, you know, quantitative easing is not about stimulating our economy. It's about trashing the dollar. And the trouble is everybody else is trashing their own currencies, too. So it's a global currency war to try and drive down everybody's currency. So we end up with zero interest rates all over the place. Anybody with any wealth can't get any return on it without taking absurd risks, and you end up with all kinds of stupid, risky investments going on, money being directed in the wrong directions all the time.
Right.
This is where markets just have fallen apart.
Right. Well, it's back to, you know, are we going to use the financial system for economic warfare? Are we going to use it to allocate and manage resources in a market economy? And so that's why whenever, you know, I get in groups of very well-meaning young people or activists and they say, you know, capitalism is bad. I said, how do we know it's bad? We've never tried it.
Yeah. What we have is hardly
think the
what
free
I would
market
call
is
capitalism.
Right. Before you oppose markets, you ought to try them. Okay, so we've got a whole bunch of questions from subscribers. So let me see if I can.
High-rate callers, no doubt. Well, okay. I deserve it. Let it rip.
No, you know something, Jim? One of the reasons I so appreciate you, I so appreciate your work, I so love having you on the Solari Report is, you know, in the name of economic warfare, you have seen a significant amount of, you know, corporate or governmental interests fund well-meaning people who don't know better to adopt and promote all sorts of, you know, heart-wrenching, heartwarming, heart, you know, it's all stuff that manipulates our emotion into all sorts of hooey that is just not factually, doesn't make sense. And you have a great way of unpacking it. So I hope you always feel free to do that. Certainly here on the Solari Report, because this is what people need to hear.
This is why I'm in trouble, okay?
Why are you in trouble?
Well, because as you can tell, I'm a contrarian in just about every time I open my mouth, I think, certainly with my wife, so it's...
I have one member of our team who always says, she says, you're always getting in trouble. This is speaking to me. She said, you're always getting in trouble with the fourth chakra people. Do you know what I mean by the fourth chakra? It's the heart chakra. And I'm always getting in trouble with the fourth chakra people because I'm telling them things like what you're saying here. But it's, you know, this is what we need to hear. We need to hear the facts. Okay, so a few questions and thoughts read Jim Norman's upcoming interview. How many fracking holes are there present in the lower 48? What's the average production life of a fracking well?
Well, I don't have all the statistics handy, but as I think I might have mentioned earlier, we drill about 40 to 45,000 wells a year in the United States. Of those, about three quarters now are drilling for oil because that's the target du jour. In the past, it was mostly, or at least half, gas drilling. If you added it all up, the total number of wells in the United States has got to be into the millions easily. Now, most of those are old vertical wells, but more than half the wells we're drilling now are horizontals, and so those are all fracked. So you're adding probably 20 or 30 million horizontal fracked wells a year now. And
20 or 30
so the
million?
Production is going up. We're drilling wells, and they're all, and the actually the per well production is going up, even in these mature provinces because the technology is relentless. You can drill longer laterals, you can frack them more often, you got just better stimulants, all kinds of stuff. It's getting more stuff out of the ground. And the life of the wells is holding up amazingly well. As I said, you can expect actually a 30-year life on many of these wells. Now, the production after 10 or 15 years would fall to maybe half the initial production or maybe less.
Help me with the numbers, because you said we're drilling 40 to 45,000 a year, and then you said 20 to 30 million. I didn't understand.
Oh, I'm sorry. It's it's a total wells cumulatively drilled in the United States would be in the tens of millions, I think.
But those aren't active.
Many of them are still. A lot of old wells are still active, yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, once you drill a well, it just sits there. And even if you're getting just a modest amount of gas out of it, and particularly oil. I mean, a lot of old oil wells that have been shut in have been brought online because the oil is so valuable now. It's worth putting a pumping unit out there and pulling out a couple of barrels a day. Pays the electric bill. So
how many new wells need to be drilled every year just to keep up with the declining?
We're drilling more wells than we need to now. And
so we're adding capacity.
And the new ones are producing more than the old ones. So you're actually able to grow the country's hydrocarbon production with a somewhat declining rig count. The rig count now is like it's under 1,800. It had been 2,000 or more. Back in the early 80s, it was like 2,500 rigs working at any given time. So we're getting more efficient all the time with this. And I think we've really only started to tap some of these vast shale plays. And there's probably more out there we haven't even thought about yet. So, Or we could if we wanted to. I mean, actually, we're exporting about, it's like 2 or 3 million barrels a day worth of gasoline we're exporting. We import maybe 1 million barrels a day of refined product. So we're net exporters of refined product. I think that's where people get the impression that we're exporting energy now. We're not really exporting energy, but we are a net exporter of gasoline, distillate, natural gas liquids, a bunch of that kind of stuff. So, you know, refineries, once you have a refinery in place, you can expand that with, it's just a matter of throwing money and steel at it, and you can build more refining capacity in place. I mean, the refining industry chronically has been characterized by overcapacity, particularly on the
right.
the distillation side, the point where you just boil the stuff, the pots where you boil it. I mean, there was long been a significant overcapacity and underutilization in the refining industry. That's why it was always kind of a doggy industry, because it has such low capital utilization figures. In a typical manufacturing industry, if you're running at less than a 90% of your capacity, you're probably losing money because you've overinvested. You're not making good use of your assets. Well, the refining industry would chronically run at about 80% of its distillation capacity, and it kind of bumped along making margins. Only the really big guys made much money at it. But then when prices ran up and the margins expanded, then even smaller refiners could do well. And plus, you know, we mandated much more expensive gasoline formulations and stuff like that. So you put more units on the end of your refinery to clean stuff up, you can make more money on that. I don't think there's any fear about a shortage of refining capacity. If I look at Sunoco, I mean, that was a big East Coast refinery. They basically, you know, turned off the lights and shut the place down, sold it to an airline. Well, who was it? Delta bought one of their refineries just to make jet fuel because there was too much capacity around.
Right.
I think that Sunoco probably made a bad decision, but, you know, but that's the way they read the cards, and so I don't think we're short on refining capacity, and if we needed more, we could build it in short order.
So if you look at the sort of the profitability of our domestic oil and gas base, how do some of these other things compare? So let's just look at the Canadian tar sand and solar panels. How do they compare in terms of cost competitiveness and profitability?
Well, you know, I think the question the person raised may have been more in terms of the energy in versus the energy out. What's the energy return on investment? That's one way of looking at things, whether they make economic sense or not. But it's not a great measure because, for instance, like with tar sands, what you get out of that is liquid fuels. Ultimately, when it's refined, you get liquid motor fuels, which are very valuable. What you put into it is tar sands and natural gas, which up in Canada is dirt cheap. So you can dig the stuff up and process it with cheap natural gas, and you get very valuable liquid fuels. Now, on a BTU basis, the gas is, you know, probably on an equivalent basis with the oil that you get out of it. So it doesn't, on a strictly energy input, energy output basis, it's kind of a wash. But you're trading cheap natural gas for valuable motor fuels. So economically, it's a home run. It makes a lot of sense. Solar panels, you know, In theory, you get the electricity for free when you set them up. But how much energy really goes into making those things, and how much, you know, rare earth materials, labor, financing, all of that stuff goes into it. And then the trouble with it is you don't always get power out of it when you need it, and you can't store it very well. So the actual functional utility of the product you get out of it is handicapped, I think. So I guess what I'm saying is I think it's very hard for solar and wind and a bunch of these other technologies to compete with oil, particularly for liquid motor fuels. And that's where the real need and the value is. an economic way to move vehicles and move people around. So even if tar sands don't look like a great deal on an energy input, energy output basis, economically, they're a home run.
Right. Right. Now, it's funny, you know, in the breakthrough energy world, you'll see all these, you know, sort of the Japanese inventors, he claims he can run cars on hydrogen or water or these other things. And I've never known what to make of them. The one thing I will say is if such a thing ever came into being, you know, I would think it would have a devastating impact on, I mean, changing the infrastructure over of an entire industry worldwide is an enormous and gut-wrenching thing to do. So I have no idea if any of these technologies really work or if you have an opinion on that, but if they ever do, do you think fracking is going to cause water problems? What do you think that, see what that would do? I don't know. Do you have any comment?
Well, I just think that it's just really hard to beat gasoline as a medium for transporting and using energy in a really powerful way. And, you know, I don't own a car because I live in New York. If I were to buy a car, I might buy a hybrid, but chances are I'd get much more bang for my buck if I just bought a fuel-efficient, gasoline-powered automobile. You could probably buy and throw away three of those for what you'd pay for some expensive hybrid. Besides that, the cost of operating a car, fuel is de minimis almost when you look at the total cost of owning a car, especially in New York. You got to insure it, you got to park it, you got to pay the tickets. You know.
Well, I remember in 1985, I was paying $450 a month for parking in New York.
Yeah, well, it's that much and more. I mean, it's total piracy. But in New York, it's just not. Plus, think of all the time you spend sitting in traffic jams. What's that worth?
Right.
I mean, this is one of the reasons I think that miles driven has been on the decline. People are just tired of sitting in traffic, and we can work at home now. So why bother?
So let me turn to transportation, because one of the things I'm very interested in and follow is what's happening in railroads. And we're seeing more and more indication that one of the big plans for moving around increased domestic production is with rail. And, you know, shipping oil from North Dakota out by rail to the West Coast. How is this stuff going to be moved? How much is it going to be pipeline? How much is it going to be rail? How much of it is going to be truck? What are the implications for the transportation infrastructure?
Well, I think rail makes lots of sense. It's not as cheap as pipelines, if you could get a pipeline rail in the long run. But on the other hand, if the production subsides or moves around somewhere else, you don't have a lot of embedded infrastructure. You can move those rail cars wherever they need to go, you know,
right?
As long as you got a track there. So rail makes sense. Plus, you can batch. You can move small batches of different grades of crude oil. We're in a pipeline. You don't really want to be mixing lots of different grades of crude in a pipeline. Because it kind of fouls things up. So,
how much can be moved by ship? Is there any amount that can be moved by barge or ship?
Well, within the United States, you know, it's awkward. There is some oil barge traffic on the Mississippi, but I think that's not real popular. There's not a whole lot of that. See, I think that it's better to use rail. You could take the railroad down the Mississippi and get oil to exactly where you want it without having to handle it many times. If you're moving oil between U.S. ports, you're subject to the Jones Act, and so that's expensive.
Well, when Buffett bought Burlington Northern, I sat up and said, okay, what's up? And then when he took it private, I said, okay, now I really want to know what's up, because he wants to keep this secret. And then Carlyle came in and bought one of them, and I said, okay, I'm going to start looking at railroads. So, you know, clearly they're planning on using railroads for a lot.
When they're not in expansion mode, they're cash machines. I mean, they generate vast amounts of tax deductions, depreciation, and so forth.
Right. Well, the other thing is, I drove through the ice storms when I was in coming back from California this time, and what was interesting is I've never seen as many trucks totaled as on this particular storm. And, you know, the railroad, the trains, you know, hundreds of cars were just flying by in the middle of the blizzard. So I think if you're worried about weird weather, there's a compelling case to be made for railroads as well. So let's talk about investors. If you're an investor and you're looking, you know, you're looking at the world of energy, and you're watching, you know, sort of the debate about U.S. self-sufficiency. You're watching the debate about renewable. You're watching the debate about nuclear. You're watching the claims on Breakthrough Energy and Al Gore saying all of this is going to wipe out the stock market valuation of fossil fuels. It can be very confusing. It's very, you know, you're almost tempted as an investor to say, you know something, I'm just not going to have anything to do with energy. I'll go focus on industrial. So if you were talking to investors in terms of areas or sectors, what do you think is important to know? So I would say that from our conversation, number one is that you think oil and gas is going to be quite long-lived.
Well, that's my hunch, until it's not. You know,
right.
I mean, if the geopolitics changes and it could flip overnight, then, you know, you're back into the early 1980s mode where everybody was going bust. So I think that's why companies like Exxon and the majors don't go hog wild over investing and play their cards very cautiously, because it is a cyclical commodity industry. And as I say, the fundamentals don't look good. I mean, there's plenty of oil out there. If markets were allowed to equilibrate, oil prices would be much lower, and
right.
Probably a significant amount of investment that we've seen lately would be uneconomical.
Well, it's interesting. If you go back and read the oil card, you're describing the years in which the price was brought way down to kind of bust Russia and the Soviet Union. And I agree with you. I think that was the lead strategy in sort of busting the Soviet Union. And if that kind of scenario were to happen again, you're talking about a dramatic change in fortune in this industry.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Especially now, because in good times like this, I mean, everybody has flocked into the oil and gas business. And so there's lots of new companies and lots of IPOs, and, you know, huge numbers on the stocks, you know. But oil and gas companies, I found, are notorious in basically squandering wealth. They find
right.
various ways to squander wealth. I think that perhaps a more cautious approach would be to look at the oil field service industry. Those
right.
guys make money in good times or bad, generally. And I think have much more control over the price of their products. And so it's kind of an indirect way of benefiting from it. The big guys pay some dividends. And I think they're well managed, by and large, and transparent.
The area I've been much more interested in is if you're going to significantly drop the cost of production in the United States, Then you're talking about potentially rebuilding the industrial base of the United States and then the transportation base as well. And to me, what could happen there could be very, very interesting. Now, my prejudice, which is a different topic, is I think there's, if you look at what they're doing in terms of, rebuilding our capacity to do certain things, including space programs, private space programs, I think there's tremendous demand for a strong industrial base here for reasons that have nothing to do with, bringing the price down. But the combination to me is much more interesting. So it's not so much energy or oil and gas itself or the different forms of energy, but what does a lower, steadier supply of energy allow you to build and to do as a society? And to me, that becomes very, very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's true. Technology is relentless, and who knows what's going to come down the pike here. As an investor, though, it is very frustrating because you can get killed on some of these newfangled things. And I guess I tend to gravitate towards known technologies and assets that you can see and touch, and cash flows and good balance sheets.
I used to have a partner and say cash flow is more important than your mother. But that's that is the ultimate test. Does it cash flow and can it cash flow? I think to me that the most important takeaway for investors is if a society can have a long-lived and steady supply of low-cost energy, then it has a platform to do many very powerful things. And on one hand, if you're going to invest in energy, you're tortured by the issue of, am I in a market economy or in a politically managed economy, where the economic warfare is increasingly unpredictable and mean, and that creates great risk for me. So that's one way of looking at it. But the other is saying, well, wait a minute, as a society, what this is all coming together to do is to give us an incredible, in North America, platform of low cost, a rich supply of energy. And what does that mean as a society, what we can do? And that's where that's where there's something that's much more steady from an investment standpoint. So, I don't know. To me, that's the big takeaway.
Well, there's always New York real estate. It just goes up and up and up.
It's funny. When I lived in New York, the only thing that anybody, I got there in 78, and the only conversation anybody would have for 10 years is how they got their apartment for a steal during the fiscal crisis, which, of course, was 3 years before I got there. It was all very irritating.
Yes.
Anyways, right. So Jim, I can't thank you enough. This has been a great conversation. In closing, anything you'd like to add? I'd love for you to tell us how we can keep up with your work. And of course, if you haven't, ladies and gentlemen, if you haven't read The Oil Card, it is the must-read book in the whole energy world. It's the one, if you want to understand what's really going on, you have to read. I made the mistake of taking The Oil Card with me to dinner. In California, I was having dinner when I first got it. I sat down, and of course, I shut down the restaurant because I couldn't put it down. But I read it literally in a 4-hour dinner, that turned into a reading session.
The book, I think, we're at a point where we have to decide if we're going to do another printing or not, because I think we've kind of finally sold out everything we printed. You can still get it on Kindle, on Amazon and stuff like that. I have not been doing much writing lately. My wife has got me embarked on a whole massive remodeling program, so I've been I'm long on power tools right now. And having a lot of fun doing that. Might get back to writing at some point. I do try and watch this stuff. It's very fascinating. And I'm so glad that you are still interested in this. I have to say, the Oil Card, nobody else has ever actually analyzed things that way. I have never seen anybody analyze what to me is kind of obvious stuff And the book has held up exceptionally well for the 5 years it's been out there. I mean, things have come out just about the way we said they would. And, you know, as I wrote the book, I said, look, I don't know a lot of what's going on, but this is the way it looks to me. And it's held up well. It's been a useful paradigm for looking at the world. And it does explain a lot.
Yeah, it explains a lot, and it's the one book on oil and gas I've ever read that fit with reality. There are a lot of books out there that will describe the official reality, but this one really fits with reality. So
yeah. Okay. Well, thanks again for having me on. It's great talking with you, and best of luck to you.
Okay. Have a wonderful holiday season for you and yours. Thanks,
yeah,
Jim.
Likewise. Okay. Bye. Thank you.